Look, it's Sunday, March 15th. We are waking up to a world that feels increasingly on edge. While the headlines are dominated by talk of escalation in the Middle East, we're also seeing a massive divide in Silicon Valley over the soul of AI, and a sports media landscape that is desperately trying to figure out how to keep you from changing the channel. Following up on yesterday's report on the energy crisis, the situation with Iran has moved into a dangerous new phase. Here is what we know. Military analysts and several foreign policy briefings this week have been wargaming a kinetic escalation between the U.S. and Iran. The scenario being discussed involves U.S.-led airstrikes targeting Iran's critical energy infrastructure, specifically Karg Island, which handles about 90% of their crude exports. While the White House hasn't confirmed active strikes as of this morning, the rhetoric has shifted toward maximum pressure. The administration is operating on the belief that if you squeeze the Iranian economy hard enough, the regime will fold. If this theoretical escalation becomes reality, it matters for your wallet. Oil prices are already climbing on the mere threat of conflict, which bleeds directly into mortgage rates. It's a bit of a self-inflicted wound for Trump, who spent years bragging about low gas prices. Now, he's presiding over a tension that makes the cost of living, the number one issue for most voters, significantly worse. Looking at the strategic map, many analysts argue this is a massive miscalculation. By trying to crush the Iranian government, the U.S. risks killing off any remaining influence held by Iranian moderates. You don't get a pro-Western democracy by bombing oil terminals. You get hardliners who can point to the smoke on the horizon. We're already hearing reports that Iran could accelerate its nuclear program in response, with some estimates suggesting their breakout time could drop towards zero if they feel backed into a corner. Even Israel seems to be shifting the goalposts. They've moved from talking about regime change in Tehran to merely weakening the regime, telling their own public to settle in for a long, attritional conflict. Meanwhile, the spillover into Lebanon is creating a genuine humanitarian disaster, and there's talk of Israeli ground operations expanding there next. This isn't just happening over there, either. There are reports of a surge in political violence here at home. According to several monitoring groups, we've seen three separate incidents in the last 8 days, including a reported attack on a synagogue and a confrontation at a protest. Federal law enforcement is warning that extremist groups are using the chaos to radicalize people online, taking advantage of the fact that social media platforms have basically gutted their moderation teams. It's a shitty cycle. A conflict with no clear goal abroad, feeding a sense of nihilism in our own backyard. While the administration watches the Gulf, they are also trying to handle a domestic crisis that was already boiling over. Housing. President Trump signed a series of executive orders aimed at boosting homeownership through massive deregulation. The idea is to strip away construction standards and make mortgage lending easier to get more houses built fast. Congress also just passed a bipartisan housing bill that doubles down on this, offering grants to cities that cut their red tape. But there's a catch. Experts are pointing out that streamlining construction often just means building lower quality homes that are more expensive to maintain. More importantly, these federal tweaks are being drowned out by the geopolitical noise. As long as the situation with Iran keeps the market spooked, interest rates are going to stay high. You can deregulate all the red tape you want, but if a starter home comes with an 8% mortgage because of instability in the Persian Gulf, nobody's buying. Behind the scenes of all this, there's a quieter war being waged on your personal privacy. A new book by Andrew Guthrie Ferguson, Your Data Will Be Used Against You, is getting a lot of traction in DC right now because it highlights what he calls the self-surveillance trap. We've all opted into this. The GPS in your car, the smart doorbell, the health tracker on your wrist. What's becoming clear is that law enforcement is now using this data with almost zero oversight. The Fourth Amendment, the one that's supposed to protect you from unreasonable searches, is effectively being bypassed. Because you voluntarily gave your data to a third party like Google or Amazon, the police often don't even need a traditional warrant to get it. Ferguson points to a case where a man's smart pacemaker was used as evidence against him in an insurance fraud case. Think about that for a second. The technology keeping you alive is now a witness for the prosecution. The scary part is that this isn't a partisan issue. Whether you're a protester on the left or a gun owner on the right, the government now has a digital skeleton key to your life. We are living in a default state of surveillance, and most of us paid for the privilege. On the legislative front, Senator Bernie Sanders is trying to force a conversation about who actually pays for the state of the country. He's introduced a proposal for a 5% annual wealth tax on billionaires. He wants to use that money to send $3,000 checks to every household making under $150,000 a year. Now, look, this bill has zero chance of passing in the current Congress. But Sanders is tapping into a very real anger. He cited a statistic this week claiming the top 1% now holds more wealth than the bottom 93% of Americans combined. A staggering figure, even if other economists put that number closer to the bottom 50 or 90%. Sanders is also calling for something much more radical, a moratorium on new AI data centers. His argument is that the ultra-wealthy are rushing into AI to automate jobs before the public even understands what's happening. He's not saying we should go back to the Stone Age, but he is saying we need to hit the brakes until we have regulations that protect workers from being replaced by an algorithm. Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker is echoing some of this. Pritzker is out there pitching what he calls Project 2029. It's a direct response to the right-wing Project 2025. He's pushing for a higher minimum wage, universal health care, and a total restoration of the rule of law. Pritzker's take is that the Democratic Party has been too incremental. He's arguing that the only way to beat a populist like Trump is with a bolder, faster version of progressivism. He's also been incredibly blunt about the Supreme Court's recent rulings on presidential immunity, calling them a fundamental threat to democracy. It's an interesting pivot, a billionaire governor telling the working class that he's the one who will actually rein in the imperial presidency. Finally, we have to talk about how the White House is actually communicating all of this. There's a growing sense that the administration has memeified the conflict. If you look at the official social media feeds, they're splicing footage of military exercises with high-energy music and graphics that look more like a Call of Duty trailer than a briefing. This isn't just a stylistic choice. It's a strategy. By turning war into content, you strip it of its gravity. When you flood the zone with flashy visuals, people eventually just tune out. They get information fatigue. And that's exactly what an autocrat wants, a populace that is too tired and confused to ask where the money is going. The administration's open admiration for guys like Putin and Xi isn't a secret anymore. They've adopted the playbook. Treat your political opponents as non-human, and keep the public distracted with a constant stream of digital noise. The real test is going to be the next election. If the administration treats the electoral process with the same performance over principle approach they're using for foreign policy, we're looking at a very different version of America. So, here's the thing. While the government is busy memeifying a war, the companies building the future are having a bit of an identity crisis. OpenAI and Anthropic are currently locked in a high-stakes split over what it actually means to be an ethical AI company. While OpenAI began as a nonprofit, the company has recently pivoted toward more aggressive, profit-driven moves, including exploring AI-generated pornography and lifting bans on tools for mass surveillance. But that strategy is hitting a wall at Anthropic. CEO Dario Amodei recently walked away from a lucrative Department of Defense contract because he refused to compromise on safeguards for autonomous weapons. Initially, that looked like a typical contract dispute, but it turned into a massive branding win. By positioning Anthropic as the safe alternative, Amodei has seen a surge in app rankings. It turns out that in a world where these models all start to look the same, not being a dick is becoming a genuine competitive advantage. Speaking of things that actually work, we're seeing a shift in how AI is being built for the workplace. The trend of creating isolated tools is being replaced by agentic ecosystems. The standout example here is an agent called Mycroft. Think of it as a digital chief AI officer. Instead of just answering questions, it builds and constantly updates a company-wide AI roadmap. It's the difference between a tool and a strategy. If your AI isn't integrated into your actual workflow by next year, it's basically just a high-tech paperweight. Over at Adobe, CEO Shantanu Narayen is trying to prove that an old dog can, in fact, learn new tricks, as long as it owns the data. Adobe is leaning into a hypothesis-driven AI model, focusing on ethically sourced training data to avoid the copyright lawsuits currently plaguing the rest of the industry. They're also treating AI like an operating system. They're betting that people don't care about the AI itself as much as they care about the tools they already know how to use. But while these companies fight for our subscriptions, AI is quietly rewriting the rules of our cities. Urban centers like Singapore and New York are increasingly managed by AI-driven systems, smart traffic signals, and AI-routed buses. On paper, it's a win. Barcelona saw a 10% jump in on-time transit. But there's a cost. We're moving from a human-legible city to a machine-legible city. When the city becomes a black box that just processes you from point A to point B, you lose your spatial cognition. You stop knowing how your own neighborhood works because an algorithm is doing the thinking for you. This creates what's known as the automation paradox. We become so reliant on the AI to manage the city that when the system eventually fails, the humans in charge won't actually know how to fix it. We saw a version of this in Toronto, where the Sidewalk Labs project collapsed because citizens realized they were being treated as data points rather than constituents. Efficiency is great until you realize you've engineered out the friction that makes a city actually feel like a city, the accidental encounters, and the weird, uncomputable parts of human life. The takeaway? Whether it's your subscription choices or the way your streetlights work, the most powerful agent in the room isn't the AI, it's the person who decides when to turn it off. Right, and while we're talking about who decides what you see, let's look at the business of sports. The World Baseball Classic just proved it's no longer a niche exhibition. Viewership shattered expectations because the games moved to prime broadcast slots. When you put Shohei Ohtani on a mound facing Mike Trout, people actually watch. It turns out if you stop treating a global tournament like a secondary product, the fans stop treating it like one too. Meanwhile, over at ESPN, the strategy has shifted from the worldwide leader brand to the Pat McAfee brand. ESPN is effectively pivoting away from the traditional, polished SportsCenter anchor and betting the farm on personality-driven, hangout-style content. Not for nothing, this is a direct response to a younger audience that finds the old-school broadcasting style about as appealing as a dial-up modem. They're looking for authenticity, or at least the digital version of it. Contrast that with NBC, which is currently clearing out the cupboard at Football Night in America. Tony Dungy is out, signaling an attempt to fix a show that has felt increasingly stale. The problem is that the show has too many voices and too much focus on retired players who haven't touched a turf field in a decade. NBC is trying to find new blood before they host the next Super Bowl. Netflix is also making its move into baseball, but they're running into a bottleneck. Their new broadcast crew features Matt Vazgersian, who is currently pulling double duty for local MLB games too. The industry is so reliant on the same five or six national voices that there's no pipeline for new talent, which makes Netflix's big swing feel a bit like a rerun. On the links, the PGA Tour is trying to NFL-ify golf. They're proposing an expansion of signature events to make the product more event-driven for media partners. It's a transparent attempt to keep sponsors happy in the face of the LIV golf threat, even if it risks diluting the prestige of the smaller tournaments. Finally, if you're heading into the first round of March Madness, the data heads have a directive: bet the first half unders. Statistically, betting the under on the first half of all 36 opening round games has been a profitable strategy for over a decade. The logic is simple: nerves are high, and the pressure usually leads to a slow start. Just don't tell your friends at the bar. Nobody wants to be the person rooting for missed layups. Since we're talking about avoiding bad bets, let's talk about the way we're betting on our own time and careers. A few new reports out this morning are taking aim at the way we manage our time. First, data on productivity shows that excessive information consumption is becoming a primary form of procrastination. We're essentially hoarding mental clutter instead of actually executing on our ideas. To fix this, the recommendation is a literal information fast. Look, we've all been there. You listen to 3 business podcasts and feel like you've put in a full day's work when all you've actually done is fold laundry. On the personal development front, there's a new push for what's being called a self-intervention dinner. The idea is to gather your closest friends and explicitly ask them for the unvarnished truth about your personality flaws. Honestly, that sounds like a total nightmare. I can't think of anything worse than paying for a round of drinks just to have my brother tell me I'm arrogant. But apparently, that's what passes for radical self-awareness these days. Finally, venture capitalist Bill Gurley is warning about a career conveyor belt that's locking people into unfulfilling jobs. He's advocating for a regret minimization framework. Basically, looking at your 80-year-old self to decide if you should quit your boring corporate gig. He notes that AI is already starting to eat through jobs involving text synthesis. The takeaway is that sticking to a safe path you hate is actually the riskiest move you can make right now. Anyway, before you go out and quit your job, here are a few other things worth knowing. We're seeing the emergence of what analysts are calling an E-shaped economy. Middle-income families are increasingly leaning on discount retailers and buy now, pay later services just to cover the basics. Honestly, when you're financing your groceries at 15% interest, the stability we keep hearing about in the headlines starts to look like a total fantasy. Then there's a bit of a reality check on how we talk about history. The History Podcast this week argued that our modern framing of the Crusades is often missing the broader context. While the popular narrative focuses on unprovoked Western aggression, the analysts pointed to centuries of prior conflict and expansion across Europe that set the stage. It's a shitty situation, but the point they were making is that ignoring the full timeline doesn't help anyone. It just leaves us trying to solve modern problems using a version of the past that's incomplete. It's hard to navigate the present when you're working off a map that's missing half the landmarks. Look, it's a heavy start to the week, but knowing the actual map is better than flying blind. Have a good Sunday. Try to stay off the buy now, pay later apps, and I'll see you back here tomorrow.